A wonderful writer. You know his work from movies, of course, like War of the Roses. But his new book is called The Children of the Roses, and it is a fascinating book. I couldn't put it down. So I assume that everybody out there listening will do the same thing. 9 million of you go out there and buy the book, and it's amazing. All of us were left with the drama of the War of the Worlds, the War of the Roses movie that we all saw with Michael Douglas, but and Kathleen Turner. This is going to be just as good a movie, I can just imagine. I guess the first question, Warren, is why so long? What took you so long?
Well, I've been busy with other novels. It's my 27th book, and I kept thinking about what happens to people who are walking wounded and the children of the walking wounded. And it began to become apparent that I had a need to tell the story. And I went into the next few generations, of at least two generations. Maybe I wanted the people, the children of the Roses, to grow up and have their own problems. Because when I had written the first book about 25 years ago, the kids, their children, the children of the Roses, were very young. So perhaps I wanted them psychologically, subconsciously, to live out their own lives and have their marriages. I believe that somehow these human scars get passed on from generation to generation.
Unfortunately, they do. And in Josh's case, his wife had her own scars to join as well.
That's correct. And I write about dysfunctional people. And now as I get older, I'm beginning to think the whole world is dysfunctional.
Well, based on your books, it is, but I assume that you have a normal life. Are you dysfunctional yourself?
No, I don't think so.
There you go.
Actually, I've never been divorced. I've never been confronted with the problems that I write about, except through research and observation. All of my characters are fictional. And do I think I'm dysfunctional? I don't think so.
But yet
But there are those that will disagree with you, with me, I
but
must
yet,
say.
if you look at the people in the world, though, Warren, divorce is rampant, people having affairs are rampant, all the problems that are in the books, they're out there, and people are going through them.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it is amazing, absolutely amazing to me that 50% of all marriages and more break up. In one state, somebody told me the state of Oklahoma. It's almost 80%. I'm baffled by this.
Well, with those kind of odds, it's a bold step to even want to get married, and you got the people who are homosexual now crying out to be married. So pretty soon they'll be able to get divorced as well.
Well, that's true, and wait till that begins to open up, because don't forget they don't even have I'm talking about the homosexuals. They don't have the fortress, the family fortress. Many of them don't have children, and that is a further problem, because children, as at least I see it, try to keep these marriages together in their own way. And in The Children of the Roses, if you recall, I tried to develop the children, even though they were small, making bizarre attempts to keep their parents together. It was almost as if it had come down to their own subconscious lives, that the best thing that could ever happen to them would be to keep the parents together. Because if you recall, they were doing nesting, which means that the children stayed in the house and the parents visited and took over the household every 2 weeks. So there was a total conflict in the way in which they disciplined them, and they were sort of competing for their love and admiration, and it just didn't work out. But the children take it in their own hands to keep the parents together.
Yes, they do, and that's just one of the great components of the book. But the nesting thing, it doesn't seem to me like it's gonna is really a great idea. Wall Street Journal, I know, put something in it about that. It's a new tool, but I'm not really a big fan of it.
Well, I don't know, and it just, like, life is full of coincidences. My own son is going through exactly this circumstance, and it's after I wrote this book, and he is experimenting with the whole nesting proposition. Now, I don't know if it's going to work. I don't think anyone knows if it can work. I don't think anyone has really decided or come to any conclusions about how these custody battles really pan out in terms of the future of the children.
I tell you how they pan out. No matter how you do it, they're not good for kids. Period.
Probably not.
Period. I mean, obviously, a happy family, you know, of a husband and a wife, or two wives or two husbands, however it's configured, loving each other and showing that kind of, you know, faith in each other, and that's good for the kids. And in fact, Children of the Roses, your book, that's the fiber they started with, the honesty, the family first. The whole thing was emphasized by this family because of the backgrounds that these parents came from.
Well, I think you got that right. You know, who knows what the right way is? I mean, I know many people that are married and have children, and the children haven't turned out so well. So who knows? I can't believe, though, that if you break up a family, it is good for the children. I mean, it has to have scars and wounds that don't heal.
There are sometimes, Warren, I think that it's warranted when parents are visibly on each other's backs and it makes the kids feel uncomfortable, and then they separate and sometimes find happiness in another family, and the kids end up having two happy families. In those ways, sometimes they do work out.
Well, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful that it does. But in my area, what I was trying to say in both of these books, that these scars come down the line, and that if you, I mean, I wouldn't say they're genetic, but they serve, there is a way in which one generation transfers its pain to another, even though they don't realize it. That's what I was trying to say in this book, mm-hmm. in The Children of the Roses, which I hope will become a motion picture. You know, in the movies, they really promote the title and interest in the book, as well as in the circumstances of the novel. The War of the Roses, for example, still plays. It came out in 1989. It plays somewhere in the world almost daily, which baffles me. Hmm. It's taught in schools. The Yale Medical School, for example, uses it in the psychiatric classes. It's taught in legal in schools that teach the legal practice in the divorce field.
Right.
It amazes me. I'm baffled. All I write is stories of the way I observe life. And it's gratifying because it is a cautionary. These are cautionary tales. And lawyers occasionally give out The War of the Roses, and I'm sure they're going to give out Children of the Roses to potential divorce people that are pursuing a divorce situation.
Let me ask you a little bit about the movies, because I know that, you know, you've had a few things. I know one of your books was developed into a miniseries on I think it was PBS or something.
It was PBS, correct.
Yeah, and War of the Roses and Random Hearts have both been made into motion pictures.
That's correct.
I guess there's two questions here. One, of course, is I assume that having it in the movies, you make money and it sells more books. But how does it translate for the most part? Have you been happy in the way that your books have translated to the big screen?
Well, actually, I'm batting 663 or 666. I thought the War of the Roses adaptation was terrific, largely because most of the people associated with that movie had been divorced, and I think that was certainly James L. Brooks, who was the producer, had gone through a rather nasty divorce and was sensitive to the story. So I think that I'm very happy with the adaptation. They did it exactly correct. They combined a couple of characters, but they follow the book, and I was really pleased. And the fact that they had followed it and done it right made for a lasting impact. I mean, it's not about money for a writer at my stage in life. It's about conveying the story, getting people to read the books, getting people to understand what I was getting at. I was very pleased with The War of the Roses. On the other hand, Random Hearts, I thought, was a disaster from my point of view, because Harrison Ford played a policeman, which was very, very far from what I had tried to do. In my book, the character that Harrison played was an assistant to a congressman, so it was a big leap, and I didn't like it, although people tell me that the picture really moved them. So I don't argue with that. I'm just looking at it from my point of view, and I wrote a piece in the New York Times telling people that I just did not, I was not satisfied with it as an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
On the question of the Sunset Gang, which was a miniseries on PBS, I really thought they did a fabulous job. This was a whole different thing. This was about the problems of older people and what they were experiencing after retirement. So that was a whole different set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But that worked out fine. Generally speaking, Mark, the writer of the novel has very little input. All he can do is hope they retain the title and do a good job, because they freeze you out no matter what.
But at this point of your career, though, where you've had a couple of your books, and especially one of them, become a huge success, and this one, naturally, as a sequel, will be highly sought, can you then in your negotiations pull some kind of contractual thing where you get actual, you know, some supervisional?
Well, they won't. In the contractual process, even if it's in the contract, these people are used to working with each other, and you could be frozen out even in a conference. I have had it in my contract that I will sit around the table, and the best I can do is consultation unless I have control, complete control. And I don't know of any writer yet that is ever a novelist who has ever completely controlled what they put up on the screen. And that goes to from Hemingway on up and down. It sounds like it's an easy process to sit there and make demands. It isn't, because it's a constant battle, because you have the stars, the director, the producers' wives, all battling for their own point of view. And sometimes you don't even want to get into that mess.
Hmm. I understand also that the novels that you've been writing featuring Fiona Fitzgerald, which are kind of mystery books, Lifetime's considering doing a series with that?
No, well, they did. They considered it. They did a pilot, and once again, I was frozen out of the process, and I thought the pilot was awful, and what they did was cancel it. But, you know, here's another amazing story. The Fiona Fitzgerald series, six novels, was bought five times for series, not only Lifetime, NBC, ABC, CBS, round and round and round. And now they're negotiating for it once again. But that's the writer's life.
So you get paid, though, each time they negotiate for it, right?
Well, yes. There is.
So whether it gets made
well,
or not.
Whether it gets, yeah, that's right.
That's
you do
okay.
get paid.
Nothing
but,
wrong with
you know,
that.
That's what you know. You don't want to, it's just money.
Mm.
You know, you can't just devote yourself just, I mean, it may sound ridiculous to most of your listeners out there, but it's not all about money. I mean, it's about the creative process. It's about respect for your material. It's about the work. The ecstasy for a novelist is the work.
Yeah, you're right. You know, something, you know what's interesting? What you said is exactly true, and I've talked to a number of people. I remember talking to Eric Siegel years ago when Love Story came out. And he actually got so much critical harassment.
Oh, yeah.
And he made a ton of money on that and a ton of fame. I mean, it sold a ton of books because of the movie.
Right.
But he hated it because it brought him to the attention he didn't like.
Right.
And it gave him disrespect among his peers.
That happens. I must say it happens. But we live in a very competitive world, especially in the writing game. And if you're a serious writer, like I like to think I am, the price of fame, it does have its price. And if you get popular, the so-called literary establishment wants to put you down, too. So I have proposed to myself to ignore all criticism and just write my books.
That's a smart thing to do.
Well,
yeah. Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about writing. I've written 4 books myself.
Oh, well, good for you.
And I've also taught writing at the university level. And I'm one of these people who believes that the kids that you're teaching have to have some kind of talent, some kind of seed that you can work with. You just can't teach anybody to write. I understand you teach as well. And tell us a little bit about your own writing growing up. How did you learn to write, and when did you realize that... that you had the skill? I understand that you were a successful businessman as well.
Well, yeah, but first, my writing is a calling. In other words, I don't know what it is. It may be some part of the brain that that makes it happen. I always wanted to be a writer. I always wanted to write novels. But it is so competitive, and it is so difficult to get published, that even though my short stories were published early on, it took me years to get my first novel published. It was very, very difficult. And, you know, I now have 27 novels under my belt, but I still have quite a few novels that were never published.
And did you ever consider publishing them yourself, since you're a businessman as well?
Well, I do have a website, warrenadler.com, which what I have done is taken all of my books in the backlist and rebought them and put them out under my own publishing indicia. These are the older books.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in every conceivable format, from ebooks to print on demand. So they are never going to go out of print. And for a writer, your copyright, the copyright goes 70 years beyond your death. So all those books you see on the shelves of dead writers are really valuable to the heirs of the writers who wish to create something to keep their name going,
mm-hmm.
which I did, thankfully, for the technological revolution. So through my website, I publish a newsletter that goes to 20,000 people every month, sometimes twice a month. So I try to keep all my works alive.
But for folks out there, Warren, who, you know, I see you brought up another point. In fact, I published 2 books of my own early in my life when I was in college. But now that with the internet, there's a whole new venue opened up for our promotion materials. If you were just starting now as a writer, put yourself there's 9 million people listening to this interview. Maybe a few of them are potential writers. Would you do things differently? Would you actually publish something on your own? Would you put it on the internet? How would you do that first step of your novel? Because as you said, it took you so long to get it published.
Well, I tell you, I have not found the magic bullet of promotion on the internet. And although I think if you are compelled to get your book published and no one wants to publish it, as a last resort, I suppose I would publish on my own, but I will not have high expectations of other people reading it, or many people not in your immediate circle reading it. It's very difficult to get people to even recognize the book or remember it. So my advice to all young writers that write to me is, it's only a last resort, but don't leave a stone unturned before you resort to publishing it yourself, because there are a number of publishers out there, even though it's consolidating, that may decide to publish your book, so you shouldn't give up. And if you can't take rejection, don't even get into this field. It'll break your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how many times I've been rejected in my lifetime.
How long have you connected with Sourcebooks?
Well, Sourcebooks... The executive editor of Sourcebooks is a very famous editor. He's in sort of, I guess I'd call it the twilight of his career, but he is the best. And the fact that he was connected with them induced me to go with them. They're just getting into the fiction field, and with his name is Hillel Black, and with Hillel's expertise, he made many, many writers in his lifetime. I thought it might be a great idea to hook up with him, which I did, and that's how I got to Sourcebooks.
Hmm.
I have found they're just as just as promotional-minded as the major publishers. And if you don't have a major, major book that where they put out a big advance, even the major publishers will leave you stranded in the stream and will not help you because they want to have a big list, but they only promote one or two of the books
sure.
on that list. That's it's like the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
The studios will lose a fortune, but make it all back on one movie.
Same in the music business.
Yeah, and I guess it's the music business.
Yep.
But you know, Mark, let me tell you one thing. I don't know how much time you have there, but the writing life is the best life you can possibly wish for. And there's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, you get to meet the most interesting people who never existed before you got to them. If they get unruly or boring, you can kill them off without fear of incarceration. You get to visit any place on the planet in your mind without the discomfort of public transportation. And best of all, you can commute to work in your pajamas. So I think it's been a terrific run as far as I'm concerned. And I write every day, and I have not stopped doing that for, well, at least four decades. And that's my life.
What have you written that hasn't been published that you think, you know, this might be a good time for it? Are there books that you write that maybe they're not ready to be seen yet, but maybe in the future they'd be fitting in better?
Well, you can't overload the pipeline. That's the problem. If you write every day, and I make it a religion to write 5 pages a day, as long as my mind is still operating on that, I start very early in the morning. You know how many books you can put out in a given year? 5 pages a day, that's 150 pages a month. That's 300 pages every 2 months. I mean, it's a lot of work.
Be like Stephen King.
Well, Stephen, yeah, but he writes in one genre. He writes in one genre. I would be bored writing horror books or just mysteries or just that. I have to write mainstream novels. That's my calling. I can't do the other thing.
Mm.
But I do talk to my writer friends to find out what is their production. Tom Wolfe, for example, writes 10 pages a day, triple space. My friend Barbara Taylor Bradford writes 5 pages, sometimes 7 a day. And she writes double space on a regular typewriter. So does Tom. I write on a computer, and I'm very happy to do 5 pages a day. I think that's a real terrific thing.
Mm.
But I'm very interested in writers' production. Faulkner, when he was hot, wrote 15 pages a day. Hemingway wrote about 5 or 6 in his later years, standing up, and he wrote in longhand. No, he wrote in a typewriter, a little typewriter. These are little odd things. I mean, I know I'm not promoting my book, Children of the Roses, but I'm giving you some insights into the writer's life.
Well, we're promoting Children of the Roses as well because we're going to put a link right to your site from our interview.
Oh, that's great. I'm very happy.
And I already told everybody, really, seriously, to go out there and buy this book. It's an excellent book. I did not expect, to be quite honest with you, to pick it up and not want to put it down. Because I had not read War of the Roses. I'd seen the movie, but I didn't read the book. And when I started reading The Children of the Roses, it is an amazing book. You write very, very well.
Right.
Smooth, it's interesting, and it keeps you wanting to keep going. It's interesting to note that the first chapter of the book is on your website, warrenadler.com.
Right.
And that's where I read it. I had the book already, but I read it on there, and I was like, well, okay, that got me hooked. And I had to pick up the book and read chapter 2, and that's how I started going.
Well,
so folks out there, if you don't want to go buy the book first, and you just want to check it out, go online at warrenadler.com and read that first chapter. I guarantee you'll be the same way as me. You're going to go out and get it.
Well, I really appreciate that plug. this is a writer's milk.
We want
is people to read our books. You know, a book is a one-on-one communication system. That's all it is. It's not like the movies. It's a one-on-one situation. The writer writing to the reader, period. And a lot of people don't realize that. But when you pick up a book by a writer who writes a work of the imagination, it's a one-on-one deal.
Now, I guess you lecture. What do you tell people in terms of writing? Because I know when I was teaching and I did college level teaching for English, I would always tell people to kind of first write what they were familiar with and let themselves be, you know, imagining. Close your eyes and write about something you may not even experience, but you would like to. What do you tell people in terms of that?
There's nothing wrong with that advice. That's wonderful. But see, I believe the creative process happens in the subconscious largely. And what I try to tell people that I lecture to is the way to write a novel is to imagine the characters and begin the process. But don't try to outline it in advance, because the characters, once they reach a certain type of life, once they're fully developed, will create their own destiny. And when they don't, you know, you haven't got it right. And I never go to sleep at night without trying to figure out what these characters have in mind for the next day, because I dread going to a blank screen or a blank page. So I try to tell people that they shouldn't get nervous if their conscious mind is not letting it flow. But to think about it all the time. I am, even as I speak to you, Mark, I really feel that I am involved in the book and the characters that I am currently writing. And I know before I go to bed every night, before I go to sleep, that I'm trying to dope out the way in which they're going to operate the next day. And sometimes they get loose and they don't do what they're supposed to do, or they do something that's too bizarre or not in keeping with their character. You got to knock them off. And it takes about 100 pages before you know where you're going.
And one of the things that the Children of the Rose does, talks a little bit about some of the elitist stuff that happens in some people's lives, and I'm quite familiar with a number of people that I know who send their kids to private school, and we've had a big public-private discussion about this.
Right.
One of the things that's in the book is that the parents are sending their children to a prestigious school, and just like the church things that happen in Boston, there's a person at this school that is a predator.
Yes, right.
There's a very interesting, the authoritarian figure who turns out to be a predator, but there's also that flip-flop of the parents, and especially the mother here, making such sacrifices to keep their children in this prestigious school. That whole thing is a very interesting dichotomy there.
Right. Well, I a number of people disagreed with me. They said to me, that have read the book, said, well, would a mother really debase herself in such a way to keep her child in a prestigious school?
Absolutely.
And you know what my answer is? Damn right they would.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's interesting, in the last episode of The Sopranos, which I think is a terrific show, they talked about the mother was being used by the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I saw it.
Yep.
To keep the child in school. And it was almost the reverse of what I had written about, but it confirmed what I truly believe and have seen in my own life with other people. They are so ambitious for their children in this competitive world that they will do almost anything to push and push and push. I'm not so sure that's good for the children. In fact, it may...
It's definitely not.
It may be great for the parents, but not good for the children.
Absolutely. But I thought that was a very interesting dichotomy in that book, though.
Yeah, oh, yes.
There's a lot of things in here that will get you thinking. It's an entertaining book, but underneath all that entertainment and some occasional laughter, there's a lot of very heavy stuff going on.
Well, I thought so. I mean, I try to couch this terrible domestic horror stories, in a humorous way, because they're too painful to look directly at them, so it has to be oblique. I mean, a lot of this book deals with stealing candy, and it seems such a minor, inconsequential thing.
Milky Way.
But it erupts the entire family. It breaks the fabric.
Yes, it does. Well, it's symbolic, really.
Right. Well that's true.
Yeah.
But I try to make my work accessible.
Well, it certainly is accessible to anybody, but again, like I've written some poetry books, and it may be accessible to many people, but there are only a certain amount of people who read it to actually get to the next layer of what's there that they could find if they wanted to.
Well, that's terrific. You probably were a terrific teacher because you really, you know what the process is. And once you understand the process, you can tell other people about it. But, you know, you said something earlier that's most interesting. You cannot teach writing. I am absolutely convinced. You can teach craft. You can teach maybe imagery. You can teach plotting, the technical aspects. But I don't think you can teach talent. I really don't. I think that's something that's just inherent.
I agree.
In the human mind.
Yeah, I don't think that's possible. And it's interesting because in university settings, you're expected to teach every child how to write. I expect when they come to the university that they're ready to write already if they know how to write. There are some kids that have incredible creative talent, others that just have a literal talent, but they have talent. And there are others who have none at all and don't want any. And you can't kind of force knowledge on them.
They want the glory. They think they're going to get rich and famous.
Mm.
And most of them are going to be terribly disappointed when they get into the real world. I mean, if you study the lives of some of our contemporary authors, you will find that a lot of them, well, they never had creative writing courses in the days of Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald. They didn't teach those things. Now it's become a discipline, which always baffles me, even though I went to a creative writing course in the New School in New York City with people like Bill Styron and Mario Puzo were in my classes. And they didn't teach. All they did was allow us, the students, to read to each other. And the students would often offer their critiques. It was very interesting.
That can be very effective as well if there are a number of creative people in there working together and kind of feeding each other's creativity needs.
That's exactly right. That's what happened because we were able to get the point of view of other creative people. There was no degree given. This was simply like a choose-up ball game. There were a lot of people that just gathered at this particular time. I mean, it was an amazing outpouring of talent in this little classroom. But I assume it'll happen again. But, boy, it was that rare.
Mm. Now, before you became a successful novelist, this is another thing which I think is very interesting, that you owned a number of radio stations, a TV station, had an advertising PR agency. So you started a magazine. I've actually done the reverse. I actually did all the business stuff after writing. But I've always wanted to be, see, I never had that successful, financial successful writing initially, so that's why I went over to business, you know.
What happened, I'm a Depression boy, and my father never was able to make a living, and so I never took a dime from them, and it does motivate you to never have to face what we faced in the Depression days. So I became entrepreneurial.
Hmm.
I never wanted to. But I married, in my day, we married early, like 21, 22. And before you knew it, we had a family to support. And so I tried never to have to face my father's bad luck and make a living for the kids and for my wife, which I did. But throughout all that period, I would get up in the morning, 5 o'clock, and I would write for 3 hours before I went to work.
Mm.
And I'm still doing it, and pretty much I don't get up at 5 anymore, maybe 6, but I never was successful. I never found the formula to get published, but eventually it came together because I was pretty persistent.
Hmm. Now, did you? I know you have 3 sons. Did any of them inherit the literary talent? Any of them take the creative route?
No. Well, I do have one. My oldest son is quite creative. But he's creative in a business way.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have an actor son who is an actor, but I guess that's creative. I guess you'd
Absolutely.
Call that in the arts.
Yeah.
And then a businessman. But these kids have varied lives, and they actually keep in touch with us very frequently, which is terrific. And we're not a dysfunctional family, by God. I don't think so. I mean, I love my wife.
You also live in Wyoming as well. Why Jackson Hole, Wyoming?
Well, my wife did not like to live in Hollywood. And I was on the Warner lot for a while. She didn't like those people. It was so ego-oriented. And she had come from Washington, D.C., where she ran this magazine. And she just didn't like it, so we fished around for a place that might satisfy her. I'm a writer. As a writer, I can be anywhere. So we picked Jackson Hole, and she built a house, and we have a house there. And I live there and in Manhattan. I'm not going to give up Manhattan. That, to me, is the center of the art world, and I'm very happy in both places.
So, but you also started the Jackson's Hole Writers Conference, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, and I was head of the Board of Trustees of the library.
So you've integrated yourself into that area.
Yeah, I did. I did, but I'm a New Yorker. I was born in Brooklyn, and I think I'm a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker. I know the whole city, and I know all the interesting places.
Are you a sports fan?
Not anymore. I was a fanatic Brooklyn Dodgers fan, but when they left Brooklyn, that was it. You know what? Time is of the essence, and it's not on your side as you grow older, and you have to be able to apportion your time in the most productive way you know how. So I have eliminated from my life sports, which I love, and eliminated certain things that will keep me from writing. And that's what I do. And on one side, it's a deprivation, but on the other, it keeps me going in the direction I want to go.
If you folks want to check out the latest Warren Adler book, it's called The Children of the Roses from Sourcebook Landmark. And also, you can go to the warrenadler.com website and read the first chapter. And if you like it like I did, you'll go out and buy the book as well. It's a great book. And I look forward to speaking with you another time when the next book comes out.
Well, let's hope we might see each other even earlier than that.
That would be cool.
In any event, I do appreciate this opportunity, Mark. I really do.
It was nice to talk to you.
You take care. Bye.
Take care.